Is now in session. Judge Schleter, Judge Ross, Judge Riley, the Honorable Randall J. Schleter presiding.
Welcome. You may be seated to the extent you're not seated already, or if you're at the podium, you need not be seated. We have today a special term matter in the matter of civil commitment of Nicole Marie Stensrud, our file number A190900. I understand both counsel are appearing in Candiwai County, and we're by via ITV. So I'm assuming it's Adam Schrader who's standing at the podium at this point. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And I'm assuming that counsel there, you have the visual of the time. You're able to see it. Is that correct?
Yes.
In fact, if I'm reading it correctly, it shows 1457.
Yep, that's correct.
You'll get three extra seconds if you need it. We'll ask both counsel to identify yourself for the record before you proceed. 15 minutes for each side, 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you're ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Adam Schrader. So it's A-D-A-M-S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R, appearing on behalf of appellant Nicole Stensrud. And so to begin, may it please the court and opposing counsel, this case, I want to discuss a little bit, Ms. Stensrud, if this doesn't have an effect on your guys' decision. She is currently completed inpatient treatment and is at a halfway house doing well. Going to the case, this is a little unusual.
Mr. Schrader, since you did raise that issue, is there any part of that or the commitment process that might render our decision moot?
No, she is still under the civil commitment at this time.
It was a 6-month commitment?
Correct, Your Honor. Proceeding with this case was a little unusual. So in the first instance, we did have Judge Wenzel make the determination that Candiwai County remained the county of financial responsibility and there was personal jurisdiction. That was at the original motion hearing. Obviously, these commitment processes happened very quickly, so we didn't have much time to prepare for those arguments. Later on, when I found out what the county's argument was based on, I brought it back up again at the commitment hearing, and that was in front of Judge Thompson. Now, he found that originally when the petition was filed, Minnesota did not have personal jurisdiction, but now that she was present in the courtroom for that hearing, he found that any person within the boundaries of the state is subject to the commitment proceeding. And so we proceeded with the commitment, and he found that she was in need of a civil commitment.
As I understand it, the only reason that she personally appeared was because law enforcement went up and got her and brought her.
That is correct. She was held the whole time in the Fargo, North Dakota mental health institution at St. John's. And so basically from there, once Judge Wenzel ruled that they remain the county of financial responsibility, we just proceeded as if it was a normal commitment hearing. And that's why she was brought back for that hearing. So I based my appeal on Judge Thompson's ruling that at the initial filing of the petition, there was not personal jurisdiction. And so we did not go into the fact that whether she is a resident or not. We based it on the fact that the judge found that she was a resident of North Dakota. And then we moved into personal jurisdiction from there. So in the briefs, we looked at specifically the 5 factors that Minnesota looks at for personal jurisdiction. The first one being the quantity of the contacts with the forum state. Second, the nature and quality of these contacts. Third, the connection of the cause of action with the contacts. Four, the state's interest in providing a forum. And 5, the convenience of the parties. Now, the first 3 obviously establish the minimum contacts for the purposes of satisfying due process. And then the last 2 to determine if the action offends the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. So we look at the first one, quantity of the contacts. We look at the fact that she didn't, outside of her family and friends, once she left, she did not have any other contacts with Minnesota, so she no longer had a driver's license. She wasn't under any kind of supervision with Candiohi County. She wasn't seeing a therapist or being provided medications, anything like that, that would still have some kind of ties with Candiohi County. We look at the nature and the quality of her contacts, and that's to look at the whether she purposely availed herself to the benefits and protections of Minnesota through her contacts. And here, obviously, that's not the case. She wasn't seeking any kind of help from Candiohi County after she had been released. She wasn't receiving any kind of benefits from the laws of Minnesota at that time either.
Mr. Schrader?
Yep.
My question, when I look at the appellant's respondent's brief, the focus, of course, and I don't think there's any dispute, is the long history she's had in Minnesota, as well as the mental health treatment she's received from Candiohi County, and that the fact that it had only been a matter of weeks, the way it looks like, when she was discharged and actually then moved to North Dakota. My question is, in terms of those, what's your understanding of the case law in terms of the period of time we should look at for the contacts, the quality of contacts, as it relates to this civil commitment petition and personal jurisdiction?
I don't know if there is a specific timeline. At least I didn't find one in there in any of the research that I did. Basically, it was, if we're looking at specific jurisdiction type issue where this, which I would think this would apply in this case, because we're looking at her drug use and mental health, those are pretty specific events. I would tie those specific events to personal jurisdiction. So there's not really a timeline there of if she's a non-resident, how long did she live somewhere else? Once she established that non-residence, I feel like the county should have to show, in order to proceed with the petition, that there was some kind of connection here. So not specifically a timeline.
So the judge found in the findings of fact, or this is in the petition for judicial commitment, so maybe it's not exactly the judge's findings of fact, but respondent is homeless and has settlement in Candiohi County for purpose of judicial commitment. I'm not sure what settlement means if she expressed that she was going to move to Fargo to be with her husband.
I am not sure. I am not sure what that meant either. And specifically, we do know that she obviously moved to Fargo and had all of her belongings there, worked a job there for a short period of time. She had a prior residence in Willmar, so maybe that's what they were defaulting to in this case. But the pre-petition screening team even went ahead and found that she was a resident of Cass County, North Dakota.
Is this really a personal jurisdiction case or a subject matter jurisdiction case?
I found that it was a personal jurisdiction issue based on the fact that Candiohi County or the district court has the right to hear commitment cases, and so that eliminated the subject jurisdiction for me and in my research that I did. But as far as personal jurisdiction goes, I think it was important to establish that once they found that there was no personal jurisdiction when she filed it, then how did the court gain personal jurisdiction later on? And that would have had to be, obviously the court had found that it was because of her presence, but in order not to violate her constitutional rights, the due process, in that sense, they would have had to have dismissed the petition and refiled it to meet that presence issue or to meet the minimum contacts. Now, we did go through all of the different cases from, there's different states that have also named cases where she could be involuntarily brought in into court. And as I discussed in my brief, Although, yes, she can be involuntarily brought in, they still have to meet a due process requirement of minimum contacts. And here, she just didn't have those minimum contacts to tie in this instance. None of her actions, even though you could say that, yes, they were all relapse, they were not directly tied to Minnesota specifically. When she was released, she was free and clear to go, essentially by saying, well, we have a long history with her. We're putting a leash on her. And anytime something bad happens, you know, if this was 5 years down the road, we could still bring her back, even if she was a resident of another county or in another state.
So the judge in the initial commitment order makes a finding that she has residence in Candiohi County. What is the support in the record for that?
I think that he just based that off of his or her previous residence and was going with the fact that they had, the county had originally been told by North Dakota that there was a 90-day time limit to establish a residence in North Dakota, and that's why they refused to take her for the civil commitment proceeding. But obviously further research on that issue revealed that North Dakota is just like Minnesota. To establish a residence, you just need to have physical presence and intent, and there is not an actual time limit for any of these issues or for them to take a commitment proceeding. So if we move on from her involuntary presence and obviously covering all those cases, In re Ivy had discussed a bunch of different cases from the states. And obviously, as I said, most of those cases have some kind of minimum contact, whether it be they committed a crime in Minnesota, they were under some kind of supervision or probation, or they're receiving benefits. And that's just not the case here with Ms. Stensrud. And so the only other option is for her to waive personal jurisdiction by being here for these the remaining hearings. And as case law suggests, as long as she properly brought it up, by her showing up at the remaining hearings does not waive her personal jurisdiction argument.
Mr. Schrader, getting back to the order that we were just talking about, the commitment order itself, that seems to be in conflict in terms of jurisdiction or residence with what the judge had orally indicated at the beginning of the commitment hearing. If I understand correctly, in looking at the transcript, the judge specifically ruled that at the filing of the petition, Candiohi County did not have personal jurisdiction, but as a practical matter would have it. So is it your understanding the court essentially, despite making findings of fact and an oral ruling that Candiohi County did not have personal jurisdiction, as a practical matter simply decided, well, we're going to have it here soon anyway, so decided to proceed with personal jurisdiction as a result?
Yes, Your Honor. So the conversation that occurred after the judge went back and did some research was that if it's dismissed at this point, the county would just turn around and refile it, and then everything would start back over again. And so the judge determined at this time to proceed instead of going that route.
And do you agree that's a correct legal statement?
I believe that, I mean, just based on the facts and everything in this case, that it should have been that it should have been dismissed and then refiled, just based on the personal jurisdiction argument itself.
Is the discussion that you just referred to with the court in the record, or you're referring to an off-the-record conversation with the court?
I believe that's in the transcript that we had. If it's not, then then yes, it would have been off the record, I guess. But that's essentially how we proceeded with that.
And do you believe factually the respondent, there's no dispute, if I understand correctly, from either the county or your client's perspective, and the judge agreed that at the time of the filing of the petition, she was residing in North Dakota with no plan to return to Minnesota?
Yes, I believe that was all agreed on by the parties at that time. It was just who was going to be responsible, or if the county could bring her back and be the county of responsibility for this.
Anything further?
All right.
In your last few seconds?
Nope, I have nothing further. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may approach the podium.
Thank you, Your Honor. Shane Baker for Gandui County. I've supplied a lot of my argument in the brief, so I won't reiterate all of that unless there's specific questions on that. But I want to condense it down into maybe some broad types of themes. And I think condensed down to its essentials, the county's position is mirrors what Judge Thompson said. I believe that was on page 12 of the transcript. And that's where he's found, he did have the finding that the petition was filed, Minnesota did not have jurisdiction. Respondent is, I'll quote now, the respondent is now in Minnesota. Minnesota law does indicate that any person found within the boundaries of the state is subject to the commitment proceedings. Then that's where he talked about the dismissal option.
Just so I'm sure, so I'm clear on it, your position is that initially there was a lack of personal jurisdiction and that failure was cured by the in-court presence?
By that, and that it meets the minimum contact test.
Wait a second. I don't know. I'm just trying to get a clear understanding. What meets the minimum contact test? Her being present in court, or let me just get right to the point. Are you conceding that there was a lack of personal jurisdiction at the time of the filing?
At the time of filing, yes.
So when did personal jurisdiction, and from your perspective, when did the court first obtain personal jurisdiction?
When she was present in Minnesota.
Present by nature of her being brought here against her will?
Yes. And that's the thing, that's what I found interesting in the case law research, is that when it's criminal or commitment matters, they do cite, and the Ivy case cited to some of these other states that basically say illegal arrests, forcible abductions, filing commitments after holdholders expire don't affect the fact that if the person ends up being in the state has jurisdiction because they are present.
So just so I'm clear in your argument, if the state of Minnesota were to abduct a person in Hawaii and transport that individual to Minnesota, at the time the individual crosses the border into Minnesota, the state of Minnesota has personal jurisdiction over that over that person for all legal matters.
That's what it's at least suggesting for criminal and commitments.
But my
it may not be for
my reading. I think criminal is maybe in a different. I don't find those cases helpful. In the commitment cases that you cited, had to do with the commitment of people who've been convicted of sexual crimes. I didn't find mentally ill and chemically dependent commitment cases.
Oh, that is true. That IV, for example, is a SDP SPP case. I don't think that should matter.
Well, so I'm trying to understand, and I applaud Candia High County, as you talk about and in your conclusion about the public policy of trying to help people that you know who have been citizens of your county and help them with their mental health and chemical health issues. But I'm looking now specifically at 256G.04 subdivision 2, which says a person retains county and state residence so long as a person's absence from Minnesota is viewed as a temporary absence within the context of the affected program. And as I understand it, everyone agrees that when she moved to Fargo, it was not temporary. She was moving there to live with her husband and had no intention of coming back.
That's correct. I mean, if this case comes down to simply that she established residence in North Dakota and that's it, that's the end of the case.
And then with regard to the fiscally responsible county, as you note in your brief, when I read that statute, it's about counties within Minnesota. It's not about a county in Minnesota and a county in a different state.
That's my understanding, too, that it's doesn't address what happens when someone moves out of the state.
Okay.
So here's my question. So if your jurisdictional argument is correct, I guess it wouldn't matter whether the individual ever had residency in Minnesota.
No, I think that's where the minimum context test comes in, because that's also designed to address due process issues. That was in the unpublished, where that's laid out more clearly, of commitment of Larson, 2009 case, where they say you need both the physical presence and that it doesn't violate the due process. And the due process is the five-factor test. And because that's where it talks about, well, if they weren't here voluntarily and that, but they didn't meet the test, that then a commitment individual would have a grounds for saying there should not have been exercise of personal jurisdiction.
So under your reasoning, it would seem to me that regardless of how far Ms. Stensrud traveled away from Minnesota and how long she had established her residence in another state, Minnesota would always have personal jurisdiction under the circumstances here where a family decides to collect her up involuntarily and bring her back to Minnesota.
Well, that raises a couple different. If it's a family member bringing her back, then I think it's just simply physical presence.
We'll refer to the same circumstances of this case, not the family members, but the state effectively collecting her up from some other state.
Well, then I think what you deal with is how much time has elapsed.
Why would that matter?
From the time when someone moves out. I'm not saying that they don't set up residence in the other state, but at what point does that minimum contact start to evade and evaporate? And our position here is that at least during what would be a typical county of financial responsibility situation, that the state should have established minimum contacts for that period of time, which is about at most 90 days. Because it's two full calendar months and then whatever part of the month they've moved. That's when a county of financial responsibility changes. And I'm saying that as a gauge on how you can measure what a minimum contact is.
Does the minimum contact analysis hinge on a temporal relationship?
I think it can. It depends on the circumstance of the type. That's why I think you have criminal matters are different than business type matters. Ivy, when the court announced that, they had a footnote saying that we view criminal cases favorably in the commitment context. That's where I used a lot of its proceeding or arguments here. And I think that Ivy is also a good example too, because the state had no authority to have Mr. Ivy in Minnesota. That's why I think the court's decision local here on who is the county of financial responsibility and that we had a basis to file a civil commitment petition here saying that was okay because we're that is no different than when the district court said there's a 10-year conditional release term. Later that was decided that was an error, just like here. Later is decided the CFR determination was a legal error. So if the court, district court, in setting the original five-year conditional release term in Ivy had done it right, Ivy would not have been in Minnesota when he was transported back here for that civil commitment case. So that's why I'm saying there was a legal error that was made that resulted in the person being transported. Because Ms. Stensrud was not in Minnesota until after Judge Wenzel made his decision.
Would you agree, Mr. Baker, that just raises a point that the legal error occurred here when the judge issued an order to apprehend out of North Dakota? In other words, if the judge knew what the state's conceding now, that the state had no personal jurisdiction, the court at that point should have simply denied the apprehension request that the county had for lack of personal jurisdiction.
That's correct. Just like Ivy. If the court at that time knew that it should have ordered 5 years instead of 10 years, then the state would not have had DOC supervision on Mr. Ivy.
Would you agree a key distinction, though, in this case, and that is that everyone concedes that prior to that order to apprehend, there was no supervision, no hold, no ongoing commitment. There was no connection by the state of Minnesota to her anymore.
That's true. I would agree with that. And I think part of the minimum context test issue, probably one distinction between the appellant and the county is what is treating as the contact. They're very focused on the fact that Ms. Stensrud moved out of the state on March 1st, set up a residence with her husband in Fargo, and moving forward. And we're basing it on, that's not the issue of the case. The issue is her mental illness and chemical dependency, which spans not just from that date, but going back years later, which I think is no different than Ivy, because the Ivy commitment is based on the past conduct. Ivy itself, there's nothing that, when that petition was filed, was based on what he did at that time.
Would it be true, Mr. Baker, at least as to the third of the five factors, the county would have to concede there's absolutely no connection to the underlying incident that led to mental illness and the state of Minnesota?
No, I guess that's where I'm looking broadly at mental illness. That, it doesn't just go away, problems of mental illness. It gets cured, it gets fixed, it gets addressed through medication and other treatment, and then sometimes when that's not being done, it flares up again. So we're looking at it as a broad...
Perhaps this follows the Judge Ross's question to you, then someone who's been committed once and discharged and goes to another state, the point you're making is that because it's not unusual, mental illness may come back, that person always retains or is always subject to personal jurisdiction here in Minnesota.
Well, that's where I don't think we have the always. I'm not sure what happens with the case 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, even a year down the road. We're dealing with a case that was 1 month down the road. And that would be within, because the commitment statute authorizes a county to have venue on two situations, residency or the county of financial responsibility. That at least for that short period, that short window of about 60 to 90 days, that the state should have established minimum contacts that satisfy traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice.
So I'm looking at the transcript from the hearing. I think it's from April 16th, which was the day that she first appeared. And I'm looking at pages, it says 7 at the top and 8. And so the judge makes the finding that she was not under any court supervision or social service supervision at the time of the filing of the petition. And he also makes the finding on page 8 that she's living within North Dakota state boundaries at the time of the petition. And so those are the court's findings of fact, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you haven't appealed those?
No, we're not appealing those.
Okay.
No, I think what this is that the county human service department was basing its decision off of the usual rules of county financial responsibility. and we were well within that period. They dealt with a state that wasn't going to deal with her. They felt, having just worked with her, not only for the last year extensively, but for the last 12 years quite a bit, that they were the county of responsibility and should be doing something. You know, and that's what we argued on the April 15th. Mm-hmm. You know, Judge Thompson says, no, that was an error. And that's what leads us to being here, is the effect of that legal error on April 15th. Because if it's simple as that shouldn't have been made, she's resident of North Dakota, that kind of ends the case from that standpoint. And one of the other counties' interests I want to, because this isn't very fully addressed in the brief because it's not directly an issue, but it's the problem of an extrapolation. If the issue is anyone can set up residency in another state and it happens just on a moment's notice, and that relieves the county of financial responsibility in all situations, then if Ms. Stenzer, instead of parking her car outside of her husband's after he had kicked her out in 2 weeks, but in Moorhead, then Canandaigua County should be able to tell Moorhead and Clay County, she's your problem. Because if the connection to the state evaporates by setting up residency in another state, then there shouldn't be any revisiting of who is the county financial responsibility later. That her connection to the county has evaporated at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, if you wish, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ready to go?
Yes.
All right. just to touch on a couple things that were brought up. So in the Ivy case, I believe there is a significant difference here with personal jurisdiction, even though there was a legal error that occurred. That could have also been the argument here if the court would have dismissed it and refiled the commitment petition in order to save her constitutional rights to due process. But that's not what happened. Obviously, we just plowed through it and kept going with the commitment proceeding.
So let me see if I understand right. Are you conceding that if the district court had dismissed the case and a new filing had occurred while she was still present in the state, that that would have met personal jurisdiction requirements?
Because she would have established her, well, she wouldn't have established her residence, but she would have been present here, which I believe was, well, I guess in the commitment proceeding, it had to be a residence. So that still wouldn't have established a county of financial responsibility or residence part of filing the petition. Yeah, so that, I'm not conceding that part. Sorry.
Well, I'm talking about personal jurisdiction, not the statutory authority to file in any particular county.
If she was present here, then I believe, yes, they would have been able to file the petition, because then she falls within that little part of it was what Judge Thompson had said, if you're within the borders, then you're subject to the commitment proceeding. But that wasn't the case here. Obviously, she didn't, or they didn't dismiss it and refile it with her present here. So then it violated her due process rights. I also addressing the part where she left, and even if she had moved back to Minnesota for a short period of time right across the border, and how that would relieve Candiota County, I don't believe that would have the effect that the county had just discussed, because then the statute would come into play if she moved back, and then the 2 calendar months would essentially take effect. As far as the other arguments go for civil commitment and chemical dependency and what happens if somebody moves away after being committed, I don't think we can just throw out a gray area of, well, what if they only move away for a few months? I think it has to be a hard timeline. She obviously had committed all the, or had the civil commitment. She completed that, and all of her doctors and therapists approved that she had done everything she needed to do and was rehabilitated at that time. So I don't think there should be any kind of leash on her, preventing her from moving away. That's all I have. unless you have any further questions.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you to both. You're welcome. Thank you to both counsel for your statements and arguments and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a ruling. Have a good afternoon.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
You as well.